Welcome to Pushback, a social justice podcast produced and distributed by Philadelphia Magazine and Word Radio. What's up, everybody? This is Flood the Drummer.
And this is Malcolm Burnley.
Thanks for downloading Pushback, and this is the second episode in the Politics of Pot series. And this time, we're talking about criminal justice. So, Malcolm, they're talking about renewing the war on drugs as if the first one was a great success. I mean, this is literally like what the fuck moments, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, we thought it was over. I mean, it seemed like all signs throughout the country over the last, 4 or 5 years have been leading to, particularly with marijuana enforcement, just an awareness of, how programs like DARE, I would say, and also just how the government has approached drug enforcement have led to mass incarceration. I mean, issues like...
of a particular race, too.
Right. Issues like civil forfeiture, issues of stop and frisk, they're all tied up within marijuana enforcement. So it seemed like we were getting more and more progressive. Trump gets elected, and now we have Jeff Sessions.
Yeah, and he's a guy who's saying that we need to understand that marijuana is a bad drug. We have to get back. He reminds me of the South Park counselor who used to be like, "Don't do drugs." That's who he reminds me of. I mean, literally social attitudes. We talked about this in the first episode with Chris Goldstein and Lynn Washington. Social attitudes are changing towards pot. There are now as many marijuana smokers as there are cigarette smokers. 55 million Americans are smoking marijuana. The majority of them are millennials and parents. I mean, there's studies that say people don't even care if their clergy person smokes weed, right? And then you have this guy, Jeff Sessions, from like the backwoods of Alabama or something, who's like stuck in 1950s, and he thinks that, hey, you know, a war on drugs is going to work. What I'm interested in is you know, his one of the people he's bought in has talked about how they're going to use marijuana as, I guess, the lost leader in terms of interacting with the Hispanic community, meaning, in other words, if they're going to go into the community saying they're looking for marijuana, and if they find illegal immigrants with marijuana, that's going to be their probable cause for deporting them, right?
That's terrible.
And so it'll be interesting to see if the Hispanic community in mass kind of starts to engage this war on pot, in terms of if pushing back.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
When you think about the legalization conversation, you don't really hear from them.
That's actually a really interesting point. I mean, I think that's part of the reason why the NAACP and the ACLU have considered marijuana enforcement a civil rights issue. Different, but it's the same idea in the black community often when they would stop someone, say, for smoking a joint or for having a nickel bag. And then if they had either more, you know, they'd be arrested. Or as we'll find out with the story of Anthony Hirschbiel, even just a nickel bag can get you basically in this dragnet and you get caught up in the criminal justice system. You have a record. You're more likely then to be a recidivist, et cetera.
Not get a job.
I
mean, you know, ahead of this recording, I talked to a drug dealer off the record, of course, and, you know, he told me about, you know, he started selling drugs at 17. You know, he's almost 27, so almost a decade in the game. And he could remember back when the cops would roll through the neighborhoods in South Philly, of course, before it was gentrified, but they used to run through South Philly and, you know, literally the guys would be sitting on the steps smoking. The weed would already be lit. And, you know, they would throw it when they see the cops coming. The cops would stop them anyway. The cops would put manpower into trying to find the half-smoked Dutch just so they could get something on them. And so the person told me, the cop came to them and said, well, do you have a record? And they said, no. And the cop said, well, you will now. Wow. And it was almost like a fucking sport. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like finding people that didn't have records and putting one on them. And the real reason was because those cops wanted to be able to go to court and get overtime.
Absolutely.
And testify.
Absolutely. So I was actually reading before this, the RAND Corporation put out this study from a few years ago, and they looked at one state. They looked at Vermont and marijuana enforcement. And what they found was per marijuana offense cost over $1,200. So per time someone was stopped for marijuana cost that much. That adds up to tens of millions of dollars in law enforcement. That's
what
we're paying
for. How much weed you could buy for $1,200?
Well, that's the thing. These are taxpayer dollars, right? And imagine if you were, you know, if it was taxed and you were paying this and it was actually going towards something else instead of law enforcement. And I've talked to a few police, and now obviously it's decriminalized in Philadelphia. But, you know, I think the vast majority of police also don't want to enforce that. I think the stereotype that you said is absolutely true, that they saw it as an economic thing. But I think that, you know, at this point, I don't even think they want to be bothering with that.
So, I mean, we didn't touch on this in the last episode, which was more about economic opportunity and just opportunity in general. But, I mean, you just kind of mentioned it in the same conversation with the drug dealer. It's like they are not really worried about legalization. You would think from a business perspective they would be, like, right. That might undercut their business. But I think they're kind of under the impression that there's always going to be need for a black market because no one wants to tax it.
I mean, right. Reefer madness.
It's reefer, you know what I mean? Look, I mean, people are going out of their way not to pay a soda tax. You know?
Right,
so,
right.
I mean, I think people are like, yeah, legalize weed and let's tax it. And then you tax it. And it's like, well, I want a dime bag. And then a dime bag is like $13.50 or like $15.35. And you're like, paying, oh, man, fuck, I just go to the guy around the corner, right?
That's hilarious. I mean, just the concept of paying for weed with change is hilarious. Yeah, like, you're counting out like $13.19.
Or the concept of paying for weed and getting change back. Like, paying for weed with a 20 and like getting change back. That could be pretty interesting. But no, all seriousness, I think that, you know, if we're not full legalization by the end of 2018, I may be cool with that, but we cannot renew the war on drugs. I mean, that's bullshit.
Absolutely.
And you know, and a lot of times we just talk about the war on drugs, but there's never like a real face to it. We talk about faces and mass incarceration, but we don't actually humanize it, which is why I'm really excited for you guys in the listening audience to get to meet Anthony Hirschbuehl. He's 27. He was arrested the first time at 15. For a nickel bag of pot, you know, grew up in Overbrook, was on a academic superstar at West Philadelphia Catholic.
Which is a great school.
And his life was ruined for a nickel bag of pot. And if we renew the war on drugs, we're going to have hundreds of Anthony Hirschbuehls around our country. And we have to say no to that.
Absolutely. He's a really powerful story. And then the second conversation is with Keir Bradford Gray, who is the chief defender of the Philadelphia Defenders Association. She was also formerly, as of, I believe, 3 years ago, was the chief defender in Montgomery County and was involved in a lot of progressive ideas about diversionary programs and ways to, I guess, prevent people from getting drug charges on their criminal record. And Keir also was rumored to be at least thinking about a run.
Her name was definitely floated around.
Okay, maybe I went too far there. Yeah.
No, I think it was rumored. She was rumored to be a DA candidate. For whatever reason, she didn't run. Clearly, you know, her name was out there. And so I think it's interesting. It's going to be interesting to see where she is on this. And I'm more interested in how her work as a defender is going to change if this war on drugs actually happens. I think people in the city want to know, how is the Public Defenders Association going to be dealing with what seems to be what's going to happen to be a spike in arrests, right?
Right.
We're talking about a war on drugs. We're projecting a spike in arrests, which means the majority of those people being arrested will probably be poor black and brown people who would need a public defender.
Right.
So the last thing I'll just say, too, is since we're talking about public defenders, I wonder if the renewed war on drugs will impact white people equally now that they're smoking weed equally.
In a weird roundabout way, right, would that be an optimistic sign? I mean, that's a weird thing to say.
It's a weird thing to think about, right? But it's something we should consider.
Right. Because so there's, you know, all sorts of metrics we can get into about the disparities in arrests, but they're pretty terrible.
Yeah.
So Keir's been really candid, and she's always really outspoken about the Defenders Association and the work that they do. So we are going to talk to Anthony first, then we'll bring on Keir, and I think it's a great two great conversations.
Anthony, thanks for hanging with us and joining this conversation. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So Anthony, as you know, this conversation is about the politics of pot, and we wanted to have a particular conversation around criminal justice. And just the little bit that I've learned about your story, being arrested initially at age 15 for a nickel bag of marijuana, I thought, you know, kind of encapsulates this whole narrative of what we're trying to do in terms of reform. And you represent that type of story, right? People can look at your life and say, okay, this is not just a narrative. This isn't just like a movement. This is a real person, and these are real people that it's happening to. So just tell me a little bit about, tell us a little bit about your story. What happened to you?
So when I was 15 years old, I had an academic scholarship to West Catholic. I was a freshman.
West Catholic High School.
West Catholic High School,
okay.
in West Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
So after school one day, we got out at like 1 o'clock, and me and my friend used to go across the street and smoke. And a cop chased us. He caught us. I had a bag of weed in my pocket. And I was let out the next day, but when I came back to court, I was sentenced to 6 months probation. This 6 months probation, about 3 months into it, I had a dirty urine for smoking, and my PO ended up locking me up for like 2 months. He let me back out. I was home for like 2 months before I had another dirty urine.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sent away for 9 to 12 months.
Wow. And this is at age 15.
I was 15. I just turned 16 when I was sentenced to 9 to 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was released.
Where did you go? Where did you have to go for the 9 to 12 months?
All right, I went to George Junior Republic. It's outside of Pittsburgh.
Wow.
Yeah, so I was really far away.
Far away from your family, right?
Yeah, like far away from everything. Yeah.
Did they come visit you while you were there at all?
I got one visit. Was too far for them to give us home passes.
Okay.
They didn't. They only did home passes if you were out of state. There was about like 2,000 kids there. It was an all male facility. So I went from West Catholic.
Wait, so just while you were there, I mean, when you were there, did you find that your story wasn't unique? Did you encounter other young men who were there for similar reasons, or were you kind of in a sea of sharks?
I kind of didn't want to tell my story because I felt like it wasn't major enough.
Okay.
And I would be looked down upon or like judged. I'd be picked on. Yeah, because like there's people here and I'm thinking that there are people, you know, that was selling crack, shooting, you know, shootouts and stuff like that. But they were probably regular kids like me when I look back on it.
You didn't find that your story was important enough. Was there a moment when you did realize, was it while you were there, you realized, okay, maybe my story is worth telling? Or did you have to like come out and once you hit society and you learned what the public discourse was, then you saw, okay, my story actually matters?
I found out that my story actually matters at the age of 27, like 6 months ago.
Wow.
Yeah. This wasn't something that happened and then my life went back to normal.
Mm-hmm.
For the past 13 years since then, I've been in and out of, I've been in jail, on probation, or on the run.
Mm-hmm.
I just maxed out probation 3 months ago, and that's the first time I'm clean since I got caught with that bag of weed.
Okay. Wow.
So I keep thinking, like, you know, a normal teenager, like, I probably smoked weed just like you did after school, during school. Except the only reason why I'm here is because I was privileged not to have been arrested or picked up. Do you ever think about...
I didn't realize how sheltered I was because I didn't even know people smoked weed in high school.
Yeah, I mean, so, like, I was smoking, you know, if not... Well, I was smoking often in high school, let me just say that. But like I said, I was just privileged. Do you ever think...
Well, why do you think you were privileged?
Because I never got caught. You know,
okay.
I never got put in the same situation. And I think that's probably the only difference between our two.
But you didn't feel like you were privileged while you were smoking. Like, you knew that when you were smoking, you were taking a risk. Like, you didn't feel like, oh, I'm in a place of privilege. I know I won't get caught.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And then, I mean, I think this kind of leads into the question I want to ask, because now that, you know, in Philadelphia and a number of other major cities, marijuana is decriminalized. So that if you have small amounts, you know, I think there is an openness now that when I was a teenager, I had so much anxiety about, you know, doing that in public or even doing that in private that, you know, now it's a fine. Do you ever think about what if decriminalization had happened when you were younger, or like what if the penalties were different when you were younger? Do you ever think about, like, you know?
I mean, yeah, of course. Like, I wish a lot of things that are going on today were going on 10 years ago. There's just the fact that people are looking into these things now and they weren't looked into 10 years ago. Like, it was common. It was common for you to get locked up for a bag of weed. And when I went to jail, it wasn't like, oh, you're sending that kid away for his life. It was like, you shouldn't have smoked weed while you were on probation. You know, you're the dickhead and you deserved it.
It's funny that you say that, because as you're telling me your story, I'm thinking, of course, someone always has to play the devil's advocate. I mean, I'm clearly you've heard that before. What do you say to them? I mean, is there some legitimacy to the fact that, hey, you know you shouldn't have been doing that? You were on probation. You took the risk anyway. And so now you kind of have to own the consequences. Is there any truth to when people make that argument?
Of course. I mean, there's some truth to it. I mean, there's probably 1% that, you know, at 15 got put on probation and, you know, didn't smoke weed anymore, changed their life around and never committed another crime again. But that's, you know, kids make mistakes and they mess up. And there's outside factors that cause that. It's not like I just decided I'm on probation, I'll smoke weed. Like, I could have just gotten into a fight that day, or I just got out of jail and I don't have any friends and I'm I'm like dealing with depression, but I can't identify those things. So I smoke weed. It doesn't seem like a big deal to me. But then I end up getting another 12 to 14 months taken out of my life. I think it might be important to say the way I got arrested after school was, at West Catholic, you have to wear uniforms. So we were in our uniforms. We were across the street from the school, but I was black. Most of the kids at West Catholic were white. And the cops pulled up and, like, they, like, looked at me like they were going to chase me, and I ran. And then I got locked up, like, down the street from my school. Wow. So, yeah, I don't see that happening if two white kids were hanging out outside of the school. Like, I don't know. But things are – I feel like things are a little bit different now.
So can take me back to what you remember about when you were first apprehended, I guess, for marijuana. What did you think your path was going to be, like, in high school and beyond at that point? Good and then question. Maybe you could get into, like – how that's changed.
I thought I was gonna end up still going to West Catholic. Like, I was gonna get out of jail the next day, maybe do 20 hours community service. And even when I got the 6 months probation, I thought I was just gonna continue school and
college probably. I mean, you're obviously a smart guy probably.
So it wasn't just George Jr., that 9 to 12 months. I came home for 2 months after that. They put me in a disciplinary school.
You were how old at that time?
I was 16 when I got out of George Jr. They put me in De La Salle in town. It's like a disciplinary school.
That's in Philly?
In Philly, yeah. Like 21st and Chestnut. So there were like these were like, I don't know. It seemed like a rough school. I really didn't want to go, and I, like, missed some days. When I missed enough days, my PO locked me up again, and I sat for, like, 2 months waiting on a decision, and I ended up getting 12 to 14 months to in Glen Mills. They sentenced me to...
So at this point, you had already did a year.
Yeah.
At 15.
Yeah.
You come out at 16.
Yeah.
Now you're back in the city.
Yeah.
And... you miss a couple of days at this institution, is what you're saying?
Yeah, I was cutting school, but like, now to look at it, like, at that school, it was like people was trying to, like, roll on me. Like, it was like a lot of stuff going on at that school.
And so you were trying to escape.
I was
something.
A smart kid, like, so, and I didn't like to hang around, you know, kids that were a certain way just to be cool. I didn't like to be in a clique, so I would keep to myself, but. In certain type of environments, that could be a negative, and it was. Like, I was a loner, like, from 15 to 18.
So the second time, it wasn't a weed-related offense, it was more so for truancy, or was it all connected to that initial...
Everything was connected to the initial...
Arrest at 15.
The initial bag of marijuana. There was no crime. I was never arrested again outside of being on probation.
Okay.
So everything tied from this 6 months probation. I thought the most that they can give me was 6 months in jail if I was sentenced to 6 months probation. But that's not true. They can sentence you to however much time until, I don't know, the age limit of being
So your entire life was changed because of a nickel bag of pot.
I mean, I didn't go to prom. I never had a high school sweetheart.
You're part of the Returning Citizens Think Tank. Is there a conversation you guys are having about pot, you know, in this think tank? If so, what is that conversation like? How's that community thinking about it?
Well, in the reentry think tank, I guess we all have the same ideas on pot or, you know, punishment period. There's certain things that have been working. There's certain things that don't work.
What does work?
It's not one of the biggest issues. I think that NA polls, you know, protests, and getting weed.
And then NAPO, just to be clear for non-Philly audiences.
He's activist, was integral in getting Jim Kenney, who was then a councilman, to...
Now mayor,
to decriminalize marijuana.
And NAPO, from what I understand, too, was, correct me if I'm wrong, was a council candidate at one point, trying to run for council.
I think he ran for mayor.
He kind of got his bona fides in the Occupy Philly movement piece. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
And he's great with comedy too.
Yeah, he's
is he?
He's a comedian by trade.
Oh, we have to get him on. We've been looking for.
Oh, he's great. He's a great talker. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Okay.
So yeah, like we're dealing more with, you know, the issue of people coming home and what they have to see when they get out here. You know, making sure that people aren't getting into survival mode. Thanks to certain people and moving a certain way, it's not like a main focus point of what's going on here. today, but there are a lot of people that are looked down on and shunned for being in jail or going back and forth to jail, and it was because of weed. So we need to look at the people that this has affected already and, you know, be glad that it's not affecting more people.
Yeah, I mean, I almost feel like there should be, if weed ever did become legalized federally, when it becomes, and it seems like it's moving that way. I mean, I almost feel like, I hate to throw around the word reparations. It's probably not appropriate.
No, I think it is appropriate.
But I mean, thinking about all the people who got arrested and whose lives really got fucked up based on smoking weed. And then if it's going to be legal, it's already, you know, medical. It's already decriminalized in a lot of places. I mean, people should really think about, you know, some form of reparations, I feel like.
What would that look like? You understand the concept of reparations? Like,
I do.
Do you feel like you're owed something for what you went through?
I don't know. There's probably a lot of people that earned money off of me being in these certain Georgia Junior Republic and Glen Mills schools.
No, it's for sure.
Whole lot of money. And sure, I would love for, you know, some type of give back or like maybe even to pay for certain kids' schools. But I don't know what that would look like. And I doubt. I mean, I would fight for it. I'd jump on board if anyone was on board.
Now that the social attitudes are changing, just this month, or this year, I should say, a study was done. In America, there are just as many marijuana smokers as there are cigarette smokers. Wow. 55 million Americans now smoke marijuana. The majority of those are adult millennials who are parents.
Hey.
Right. So it's like the social attitudes are changing. Right. So if I'm a parent and I'm a weed smoker, do I want my child going to school being told don't do drugs? Do I want them in there listening to these DARE assemblies? Do I want them demonizing marijuana in school when they come home and see mommy and daddy lighting up a J? Right. I mean, so do you think that these social attitudes need to translate into the educational system where we stop doing these full school assemblies that we're telling people to stay away from drugs and don't say, just say no?
Yeah, it's been proven through studies that, you know, DARE didn't work.
Yeah.
And it may have had a negative effect. And so Nancy Reagan, you know, like advertising for that, she was wrong. And
a lot of those people were wrong.
Yeah, a lot of those people.
The whole
were
war
wrong,
on drugs.
But
was
I wanted
wrong.
To give her like a specific shout out.
Well, do it again. Shout out to Nancy Reagan.
Cause she had that innocent face on when she was promoting it, and she made like all the moms and everybody buy into that shit. So,
well, we've talked about this a lot too. That part of the reason, or at least part of the reason people theorize why some of these laws are changing, is that, you know, drug addiction is now affecting
white
suburbs.
People.
Yeah, suburbs, yeah. And white people more now. And now it's no coincidence. And then, you know, decriminalization is big. People talking about, you know, rescheduling of different drugs. And it just kind of gets back to, you know, that inequity.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because I hate the fact when that is presented as a fucking coincidence that now we're just learning we need to be more compassionate. It's not about race. We just can't afford to lock people up anymore. It's, I mean, but like when crack was tearing up black families, it was, you know, law and order, buy the books, send them to jail, mandatory minimum sentences, throw the book at them. But now that the face of homelessness is changing, you're seeing a bunch of young white boys and girls on the street, you know, with the meth face and the heroin face. And now the cops have to be trained how to save their fucking life.
Yeah.
Wow. You know what I'm saying? So when people say Black Lives Matter is controversial, I said, no, the fucking war on drugs was controversial. That's controversial.
Absolutely.
Black Lives Matter has to be said because, look.
So, Anthony, just to wrap up, what would you want people to know about you now that you are out, you're not on probation, you're not in jail, in terms of where your life's at? And also, I guess, just to let people know, like, how this has affected you going forward.
Yeah, so basically, I'm trying to, like, a big part of the problem was the stigma with, you know, people looking down on me, like, because I was coming in and out of jail for the past 10 years. It almost made me feel like I was, like, just this jailbird or that was all I was. Like, a lot of people support people around me, like, they agreed with the justice system and felt like I did, like, you know, I was stupid for violating probation and I should be in jail. Like, that's what happens when you mess up. So
no, there was no compassion.
There was nobody there that was like, you shouldn't be in jail this long for what you did. Like, it's not fair. No one agreed with that. And it made me kind of have this idea that the world was bad and really dark, and like no one cared about anything. And like, what was the point of it? Like, at a certain point. So you got to think, these little times when I was violating probation for smoking weed and stuff like that, I had friends that were getting killed around me. I had, you know, things going on. So yeah, I smoked weed, and people would be like, well, you shouldn't have smoked weed and you wouldn't be doing 11 and a half to 23 months. And I'm like, I didn't care about 11 and a half to 23 months. I didn't care about going into the next day. Like, I didn't know if I was going to make it to the next day. Like, weed wasn't the biggest issue in my life at the time. But I just that stigma, man, when everyone's looking down on me and like no one cared, and like it was like that was fair and where I was supposed to be, I had like a crazy outlook on life. Since then, I had a lot of friends around me, like positive people that have, you know, actually cared about who I am and looked at me as a person, and this basically helped my growth. So if you've been out of, in and out of jail, like I guess, man, just don't get in survival mode. Mm-hmm. Just stay out here and kind of like get involved with what's going on around you.
Welcome back to Pushback. We have Keir Bradford Gray, who's the chief defender at the Philadelphia Defenders Association. Welcome to Pushback.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So we're having a conversation around the politics of pot. I'm sure that when it comes down to marijuana arrest and the disparities, the racial disparities in arrest, that's something you see as a Defenders Association. Give us 30 to 60 seconds on what exactly the Defenders Association does, what its daily work is for those who may not be familiar with it, and what role does the politics of pot play in that?
So the Defender Association represents those who cannot afford a lawyer when they are charged with a crime. And, you know, we represent cases all the way from misdemeanors, which would pot would be a misdemeanor, all the way up into, you know, homicide and death penalty cases. And in terms of what this means in the politics of this, the way our city is handling marijuana cases, it means a lot in terms of getting some of those cases off of our caseload so that our lawyers are not so overburdened. But it's not necessarily all worked out that way, even though we've gone to a new way of dealing with marijuana cases.
Right. And just to be clear, are you saying that the caseload isn't decreasing because of decriminalization, or it is?
Well, initially it had decreased a lot in our misdemeanor caseloads. It had decreased because we were no longer stacking our cases with marijuana files. But we have seen, you know, some files that are coming back into our system, even though the city has moved to a new way of dealing with it.
So one of the things that a lot of people have talked about with decriminalization in Philadelphia is that, right, the way it works now is that you'll get a fine for possessing a small amount or smoking as opposed to getting arrested like you formerly were. There's been some controversy, I guess, about the ticketing program or the way that the city's been enforcing the ticketing program. And I didn't know if you could speak to that. My understanding was that some of the fines, if people can't pay them, maybe are being sold off to a collections agency. I don't know if that's in your purview exactly, but could you speak to that and I guess maybe just evaluate how the ticketing has gone it's been 2.5 years at this point?
I think so. So I really can't speak to how the fines are distributed because that would be outside of my purview. But what I can speak to is the policy that allows officers to give a ticket and a fine. That is a discretionary policy, so they don't always exercise that discretion in all circumstances under which, you know, small amounts of marijuana are involved. And we, our office, we staff what we call arraignment court. So that is, we know all of the arrests that happen in the city because we staff that arraignment court 24/7. So we have been kind of keeping track of how many marijuana arrests are still occurring, and not just the arrests, but actually charging from the prosecutor's office. How many of those arrests from the police department are our DA's office accepting as actual charges for possession of small amount of marijuana? And we had tracked in 2016 over 750 marijuana arrests and or prosecutions. Now, some of those prosecutions, some people do get a diversion program, which is called the Small Amount of Marijuana Program, and they get sent off to do community service and pay some fines. However, they still have an arrest record, and if they complete the community service and pay off all your fines, only then will your arrest be expunged. But some of them still make it into our misdemeanor courtrooms, where they are now still being offered a guilty plea for a no further penalty. That arrest and conviction stays on their record for the remainder of their adult life.
Are you seeing disparities in those arrests here?
So, yes, we're tracking the race and ethnicity of the people, as well as the areas in which the arrests are coming from. We are noticing the areas of the arrests are, you know, some of our low-income neighborhoods. Those are typically going to have more people of color in there than not. We see the differences when we're reading information about the police officers' discretion in arresting marijuana, the differences in how they treat Rittenhouse Square and UPenn versus how they treat 55th and Pine and 13th and Cumberland. You know, when they do raids or drug busts in those areas, you know, they arrest people because they say, well, we are arresting people to build a case against the seller. And, you know, giving a citation and keeping that as a record also builds a case against the seller. So that's not really an excuse. I've never seen in the history of me working as a defense counsel, the district attorney bring in buyers as witnesses against the seller. Never saw that, so I don't know where that logic comes from. But we are seeing disparities. I'm not in the position to tell you exactly what those are right now because we haven't calculated it recently.
But is it fair to say that the initial plan when Jim Kenney said we want to decriminalize marijuana to end the racial disparities, that's not working? Is it safe to say that?
Well, I can say under the circumstances in which we see, there are still racial disparities amongst the groups of people that are being arrested. We're still seeing that. Okay. And we're seeing in terms of the areas of the city where they are being arrested are generally those areas that are subject to over-policing and, you know, more of that policing policy and strategy.
So, Keir, when you were the chief defender in Montgomery County, and definitely correct me if any of this is wrong, but my understanding was you were involved in a lot of, I guess, progressive measures in terms of diversionary programs. For example, there was a youth court that I believe you were integral in setting up that kept some minors out of jail for crimes like possession of marijuana. I was wondering if you could speak to where we're at in Philadelphia, I guess, with, say, similar programs. I know there have been diversionary programs in the past. Where we're at with that, and if there seems like there's, you know, movement and conversations about getting more of that.
I say right now is a wonderful time for Philadelphia. It may not seem that way, but I'm seeing a tremendous amount of collaboration, not just between the criminal justice stakeholders, but also the external people and city council and the legislative people up in Harrisburg that have a Philadelphia kind of home base. I see that we are moving the needle a lot on criminal justice reform and making better sense of what we're doing in our system. We're creating opportunities for more humanization in our system. We may not call them specific programs, but we are doing them, you know, right now ad hoc. The more we learn about the success of the things that we're doing, the better we'll be at creating programs that target these populations that we seem to be having success with. You know, youth courts is an idea that I actually took from Philadelphia. Some of the things that go on here in Philadelphia are not really communicated well to the public. And I took a lot of what I learned here and brought it to Montgomery County, where, you know, we were starting from scratch. And I think what needs to happen here in Philadelphia is we need to bring together all of these groups that are working on some amazing things and really do more information sharing and collaboration so that we can get a blueprint of all the reentry and pre-entry and reform efforts that are going on to say, hey, let's not duplicate efforts. Let's just build upon each other's work. I'm seeing that happen. And you know what I'm seeing? I'm noticing it's the will of the activists that is creating the atmosphere for this type of work. I mean, looking at the DA candidates platform and listening to some of these things that I have never heard before out of DA's mouths are because people are standing up and saying, we want better and we're tired of it. And I just say, I applaud them, mm-hmm. you know, from the Black Lives Matter movement to Color for Change, mm-hmm. Working Families United, all of those people that are out here, you know, working with us, right? Because the defenders have been doing this for a very long time, but we've been doing it in isolation. Now we have so many more people that we can tap into that build the political will to do these things.
I'm glad you mentioned the DA's race because I wanted to touch on that for a minute. Your name was one of those that were rumored to run. Had you ran, what would have been your platform for criminal justice reform? And would you have centered a marijuana in that?
Well, my platform is being pretty much put out there in terms of the DA candidates. But yeah, okay. Marijuana would be extremely largely one of the things that I would deal with. Right. I think that it costs so much in terms of our resources and our system to process people through this system. It is still a biased practice that's one of the things that I am hell bent on. Excuse if I can't say.
Oh, you can say whatever you want.
Yeah. And reducing the racial bias in our system, because it's not like you're saying this is dangerous. You're saying it's dangerous for some people, but not others. Right.
Yeah.
There's a better way to deal with that. When we were looking way back when liquor was illegal, right, we started realizing you're not going to stop certain things that are not creating a huge risk to public safety, but you regulate it. You're smart with it. And I, you know, we've gotten to the normalization of understanding how to effectively, and you know, some people go overboard. Of course, there's always abuse in something things, but we've learned how to regulate it as, you know, a country. We need to come to that same terms with marijuana, and we need to stop holding on to these old ideas that this is the drug that's going to create, you know, corruption. People are going to be who they're going to be, and we know that people use this across the board. Drug use is rampant. Another one of my policies would be let's stop treating drug usage only as a criminal justice issue,
right.
And
mental
let's treat
health.
It as a public health issue.
Yeah.
Where do we want to put our money? And where do we want to put our money? The healthcare professionals who have been trained and educated on how to deal with this do it better, but we don't have any money for them to do it more, you know, more abundantly because we use so much for our prison budgets,
right.
And we let the correction officers deal with that.
Right. Yeah.
It makes sense.
I think that's a great point, right? I mean, you don't want police doing, and I'm sure they don't want to be doing the work of health professionals. I mean, that shouldn't be their job. So
I think Malcolm, if you talk to any cop, especially in this city, they'll tell you they're overworked. Mm-hmm. They don't want to do that. They don't want to,
right.
They don't want to break up neighborhood quabbles, neighborhood fights. They don't want to, you know, stop people for nickel or dime bags or pot. I mean, but if you talk to most cops, they say, look, I'm just following the law.
Yeah.
And that's what we have to get down to, the policy of it, the politics of it all. Because I don't think the cop wants to stop anybody for a nickel bag of pot more than a guy with a nickel bag of pot wants to be stopped.
I mean,
that's
I think,
a tongue twister.
I think
I said that.
I mean, I think my conversations, I think a lot of police were supportive of decriminalization, at least individual agents. I don't think they would say that on the record because I don't necessarily know if that was good or bad for the police force. But in terms of their day-to-day operations, you know, they didn't want to be doing that work, I don't think.
No, I
yeah, agree. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Kier.
I think police know what plagues the city in terms of public safety and in terms of, you know, harming the community. I think they'd rather focus their attention on that. Now, that's the ones that understand good policing and community policing as an effective
right.
strategy to reduce violent crime. But you still got those who, you know, drive overtime with those types of arrests. You still have that stuff. And you've got to look at each officer individually. What is their overtime? You know, are they consistently making the same amount because they are, you know, arresting these minor offenses? You got to weed those people out and understand what the motivations are.
So over the last few years, you know, nationally, there's been a lot of progressive legislation in terms of marijuana enforcement. And I guess I want to, if you indulge for a second, like, how far you think that might go in the future, whether in our lifetimes, if all drugs might be decriminalized, whether it's locally or federally. I know that Portugal did this a number of years ago, I think maybe in the early 2000s. And I know there's the famous scene in The Wire, the show The Wire, where they, I think it's called Hamsterdam. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. Okay. Right, Hamsterdam, where they basically let to a confined area, they let everyone sell and I guess, I think use drugs so that they wouldn't be criminalized, but it was contained. Do you think we'll ever get to anything like that where we might be decriminalizing more than marijuana?
I think we can. I think it takes the leadership to do that, though. And it takes people who are not afraid. And it takes the community to stand behind someone when they make these bold moves. But I think we have to set things up first. We can't just open up the gates and let everybody, you know, just flood on out without the support systems in the community to help deal with those things. So the funding shifting needs to start, and we need to grow our pilot programs to scale. I think we can do that. I don't think that's a hard thing to do. Look, you know what we have done? We have tried jail. We'll try jail 10, 11, 12 times with no regard as to whether or not it's working. We'll keep putting them in there. And when that's someone right. fails out of a rehabilitation program, it's not working. Mm. You know, it's the patience and, you know, the bravery that leadership in this system need to have, as well as the leadership of our city need to have, and say, here's where we're going to put our money. I think Governor Christie just started, you know, allocating funding for the heroin epidemic. You know, we'll take it. I know it's, you know, not something that we had available when the crack epidemic hit. But, you know, now that we know what we're supposed to do for people, we should apply it all across the board, regardless of class or race. I can see this happening. I can. It's not going to happen overnight, mm-hmm. but I can see it happening if we stay steadfast and people start to understand that these are people that are going to be in your neighborhoods anyway. Mm-hmm. You want them to be more supported. You want them to have more structure versus going to jail, becoming more desperate, and coming out with the same problems that they had.
So just to wrap up, Kier, do you see yourself as an activist type role in the Defenders Association on these issues that you care about, or do you have to remain partisan and kind of be objective?
That's my problem. I am totally an activist. I have to, you know, and sometimes that's good and bad, right? Okay. I have to always evaluate myself, but I always stay true to who I am. Mm-hmm. And as long as I do that and stay principled, I can find ways to work with people across the aisle. But quite frankly, I am never going to be okay with people being oppressed by this system and being marginalized. That will never sit well with me. It just doesn't, it's not within my DNA. So I do see me as more of an activist. I think the time frame right now allows for that. Mm. This is criminal justice is our present day civil rights movement. And I think that, you know, I just fell into a great space at the great time that utilizes my passion and allows me to be an activist, but also be a collaborative stakeholder, because I've had to learn when, you know, no in the hole, no in the fold, but you always stay true to the goal.
Well, it's been so great talking to you. How can people keep in touch with you? Where can people find your information if they want to connect with you, if they need resources from the Defenders Association? Where can they find that?
Well, first of all, I'm glad you said that. Please like our page. We're Defender Association of Philadelphia. We are on Facebook. We put a lot of information about our services, about expungement clinics we do. And actually, just to let your listeners know, we do expungements Monday through Friday in our office. Mm. You come in our office and you say you want to expunge, we do them. You come between 9 and 4:30. It takes you about 10 minutes. We do them.
Where are you guys located?
It's right in at our office. 16th and Sansom? I might have that
wrong. No, 1441 Sansom. So right on the corner of 15th okay. and Sansom.
Okay.
Well, and yeah, we accept everyone that we've represented in the past and we represent now, but also those who can't afford a lawyer that may have had a court appointed attorney, we accept them as well. So, you know, we want to make these things available. You don't have to wait for a clinic, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. but if you like our page, Facebook, we're on Twitter as well, you will find that information available to you, and you can ask questions and give us feedback and all of that stuff.
Thank you, everybody, for being tuned in and downloading Pushback. We really appreciate it. Remember to subscribe on iTunes. Tell all your friends about it if you don't have iTunes, and I'm sure not many people who don't. But if you don't, you know, go to phillymag.com and bookmark that, or you can always search through wordradio.com. The podcast will always publish there. We got great episodes coming up soon, so stay tuned. For Malcolm Burnley, I'm Flood the Drummer. And until next time, I'm Drumming for Justice.